my father was a very loving man. And sitting here, I cannot really remember his ever saying to me, "I love you." But I can certainly recall that my mother never ever said once in her life to me that she loved me. Knowing that each were products of the United States federal boarding school system, then I can understand it.
I've been thinking, how do we have this conversation about what Indigenous love is? What does it mean to be in love? And I recently came across this TED Talk, which has like millions of views on YouTube. It's by Robert Waldinger. He's a white guy. And
just a point of clarification.
I just want to say that much. But it's called What Makes a Good Life? Lessons from the Longest Study on Happiness. And I want to play a few of those clips for you. Listen in.
What keeps us healthy and happy as we go through life? If you were going to invest now in your future best self, where would you put your time and your energy? We're constantly told to lean into work, to push harder and achieve more. We're given the impression that these are the things that we need to go after in order to have a good life. Pictures of entire lives, of the choices that people make and how those choices work out for them, those pictures are almost impossible to get. Medical records from their doctors. We draw their blood. We scan their brains. We talk to their children. We videotape them talking with their wives about their deepest concerns. And when about a decade ago, we finally asked the wives if they would join us as members of the study, many of the women said, "You know, it's about time." So what have we learned? What are the lessons that come from the tens of thousands of pages of information that we've generated on these lives? Well, the lessons aren't about wealth or fame or working harder and harder. The clearest message that we get from this 75-year study is this: good relationships keep us happier and healthier, period.
Okay, so there's like some really big lessons that Robert talks about, that good old Rob talks about.
He's our homie now.
Rob's the homie now. he says kind of what we've been saying for a long time. Good relationships keep us happier and healthier, period.
He gives us some big lessons about relationships that they have gleaned over 75 years of following this cohort of men that were sophomores in college at Harvard University, and then another cohort of men that were from some of the most marginalized and deprived areas of Boston in the 1930s. So they studied these two cohorts. And from the study, they found three things about relationships. The first is that social connections are good for us. The second is that loneliness kills. Mm-hmm. And the third is that people who are more socially connected to family and friends and community are happier physically.
And they live longer than those who are less connected.
But also, it's not just about who you're connected to or the number of your connections, but the quality of your close relationships really matter. If you're living in the midst of conflict, that's not good. Mm-hmm. If you're living in the midst of good, warm relationships, mm-hmm. that's protective, mm-hmm. right? And so the people who were most satisfied with their relationships when they were 50 years old were the healthiest at 80, mm-hmm. 30 years later.
Wow.
I mean, that's pretty amazing that mm-hmm. you could build out a study that could then tell you how healthy you would be physically based on how you perceived and believed your relationships were 30 years prior. But, you know, this is just a classic example of the tension between Indigenous knowledge and worldviews as compared to Western systems of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Indigenous peoples, we've always known this.
Right.
I mean, we've always known that good relationships, living in good relation to each other, to our natural world, right? To everything in this world and beyond, all of our more than human kin. That's an integral part of Indigenous knowledge systems.
To think about what it means to be in good relation.
Exactly. That's why this podcast exists.
Right.
But it took an 80-year-long longitudinal study out of Harvard University, right? One of the most premier institutions of Western education, to scientifically, in quotes, affirm that being in good relation is the most important thing that matters in life.
It was really interesting when I was watching that study and it said, or when I was watching that TED talk, and it said that 1 in 5 Americans will report that they are lonely. And if, according to this study, or according to what our relatives say, that being in good relation leads to longer life and happiness and fulfillment and love, then why are we so lonely? Like, what's going on? And we actually, like, in the middle of preparing to do this podcast, we posed the question to our audience on our social media. We said, are you lonely? And so many of you said yes. You know, you said, yeah, I love my family, but I want the freedom to explore. You said, yeah, going to school off-res and having no Natives in my department takes its toll. You said, yes, living where I do, a part of me feels othered and disconnected. Some of you said, I feel extremely lonely. But most people said yes.
And so now I guess we can, I mean, clearly, when we're thinking about data and polling and, you know, there's a lot more we could do. This isn't definitive. We're not saying this is the be-all, end-all. But it is interesting to think that ultimately, you know, if 1 in 5 Americans at any one time say they're lonely, we're seeing that Natives are lonely too.
You know, it's working by design. Mm-hmm. That American belief systems situate the nuclear family and the love relationship with your partner as the most important relationships in your life. And our pedagogies were disrupted. So, you know, pre-colonization, we would teach our children how to be in good relationship. It would be built into the daily framework and also to live amongst community. Certainly here, when we lived in longhouses, ginormous 8,000 square foot longhouses with our whole tribe, you certainly were always surrounded by community, just, you know, by the way that we lived our lives. And everything was dependent upon our relationality, our survival and our way of life. Our economic system, the potlatch system, was developed to nurture relationships. But colonization forced us into these single family homes, onto our 40 acres, if you will. And that experience led to this America where 1 in 5 feel lonely. It's working by design. And so I think anytime we talk about love and relationships, we have to acknowledge that our relationships have been disrupted by the colonial system. And so part of decolonizing or imagining an otherwise or an Indigenous future includes imagining a new framework for love and relationships.
And not just romantic love. Like, I think that's also a product of this Western society that we are forced into now. This notion that platonic love doesn't exist, or it is less desired than romantic love, right? We have this, like, I mean, think about it, rom-coms, right? Think about all of, you know, these new and emerging reality TV shows where people are being matched on, you know, and The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, Love is Blind. I mean, we have so many.
Great show, by the way.
We have so many, right? Forced interactions, mm-hmm. where people are trying to build connection. And it's really built on this romanticized ideal of what love is, mm-hmm. and what that connection should be. But I really question whether that type of romantic love was the same in our pre-colonial societies, mm-hmm. as Indigenous peoples. Did we have romantic love? Was it the way we would fantasize it being now? I don't know.
And the reason we're like sitting here and imagining these sort of love relationships is because colonization disrupted our love relationships. It disrupted our cultural memory. Going into boarding schools and the forced trauma of this American system is very real. And so every time that we talk about love, we also have to think through trauma. And that's, to me, really sad. You know, it's really sad that when we talk about love, we also have to talk about pain or violence. I've heard countless stories, you know, in my travels over and over and over again with grandmas and aunties and cousins and uncles telling me stories of how they came home from boarding school and had lost the ability to love, you know, and they wanted to tell their children they loved them, but they didn't know how. You know, like that these sterile environments of these boarding schools where they were punished for speaking their language, where they were punished for being brown, when they were punished just for existing, you know, like that it
literally changes everything.
It changed everything. And then these people came home and they had babies. And that was my grandma. You know, it wasn't a long time ago. And yeah. They came home and many of them developed like alcoholism or drug addiction. And some of them didn't. Some of them managed to come home and put themselves back together again and did their best they could to love their babies. But I've heard so many stories from grandmas telling me, like, my mom never told me she loved me.
Yeah.
You know, and they weren't taught love. And it's like, if we don't know how to love, if love has been stripped from us, you know, how do we heal from that? How do we get better? How do we create a loving nation? Sorry. In our quest looking for amazing Indigenous scholars on love, we found this amazing woman, Geraldine King. She's with us today.
She's a professor at Carleton University, and her research includes Anishinaabe erotics, ethics of intimacy, kinship studies, eco-erotics, and Indigenous pedagogies. Geraldine is a poet, an author, a writer, and a mother. Welcome, Professor King. We're so happy to have you here.
Miigwech. Thanks for that introduction.
There's not a lot of research around this topic. There's not a lot of books that we can draw from on this topic. And so, you know, we are really trying to think through what does love look like right now? Because there's all kinds of information about how white people love, right? Like we all were raised on it, right? But how do we love, you know, and what does that look like? And so we thought we would start by jumping in and saying, you know, how have our ways of loving been disrupted in Indigenous communities? And what are people doing to restore those relationships?
Sure. I think, you know, you touched on one of the biggest ways or biggest mechanisms that this love was severed. And that was through these systemic, institutionalized severing and extreme violence, right, against particularly children. Because if you think of children as the ones learning these within our communities, from our aunties, from our uncles, from their spiritual leaders, from your own parents, right, this privilege of being able to share that love freely, being absolutely eviscerated, is something that I still feel like it's still, and this is likely something that we all feel, is just it seeps through your bones. Like I have this fleshy affective response whenever I think about what it means to have lost all of that and being responsible to try to revive all of that. You know, I was reading in an article by Kim Anderson, taking narratives of what happened in residential schools, for instance, and, you know, an elder Knockwood indicated that if young girls at that time did not have an understanding of what was going on with their bodies during the moon time, that the nuns would beat them and force them to wash their soiled underwear and kind of parade them on as being, parade these underwears and panties on for others to sort of perform that shame for the other children that were there. And this is how it's learned that this ceremony of the time of our monthly times is actually a shameful thing in the eyes of the church. So taking away not only that love that that families and our communities and our kin would involve us in, but also that love for our bodies, which I think is so crucially detrimental to what's happened to us. Along that line, these things just really choke me up, but, you know, along that line, I was also reading in Wendy Maucon's Genius, talking a story about a Sakamik, and a Sakamik for us is the sphagnum moss, which I think for a lot of tribes or a lot of indigenous nations had a very good connection to this particular plant relation. You know, it's antibacterial, so you would put that, that's why it's called the moss bag. It's antibacterial, it absorbs a lot, it's just integral to our nation, to keeping babies safe, right? Because it would make sure there was no bacteria, it was cleanliness. And the missionary, Genius is describing the story where women were coming together and taking that sphagnum moss from, the asakamik from other women who were in their moon time then, washing it, preparing it again so that they could rewear it. And of course, through this puritanical, like Victorian church idea of shame that goes all the way back to Eve having, like, not having been irrational and acted on her womanly impulses. So now through the generations, every woman has to suffer, right? This is their narrative, not ours. So the nuns intervened upon this practice, and that practice was like this ultimate demonstration of love for another for another woman within your community or someone who's menstruating within your community. So love as a ceremonial practice was also severed and then transformed into that idea of shame. Like the nuns just they witnessed this and they're like, this is dirty, this is shameful, you shouldn't be touching these gross byproducts. But in Anishinaabeg phenomenology and worldviews, this was considered the sacred time, and those expulsions of what was coming out in those moon times wasn't considered dirty. And you mentioned as well at the beginning, Matika, that it is difficult for the people that attended the Indian boarding schools or the residential schools to say love when they were never told they were loved by these folks. Mm-hmm. They were severed from being told they're loved by their families and communities. But I think, there's the epigenetics, but like their fleshiness took on this lack of love for themselves that is embodied, which also, so cognitively we could say, hey, you know, the way that people were treated in residential schools, it wasn't right. Here's how we love, you know, and oftentimes we've seen that cycle has not been broken. In some cases it has, but I really am interested is when it's embodied, when it's taken on as a part of our flesh and our blood remembers that not loving, how can we change our body? Because sometimes I think it's easier to change our cognitive ability to re-love. But when it's embodied, I find that's just so much more, it's so much more difficult and pervasive, I think, to remedy.
Yeah, it speaks to this kind of disconnect between our minds, right, and our bodies, and that as human beings, we can get our minds to, you know, our minds are so powerful. We can get our minds to do anything. The kind of override that our minds have over our bodies, I see it as a survival mechanism. You know, we get our minds to override the feelings that we have in our bodies. And we've had to do that generation after generation to survive. I mean, I don't know about you, but I didn't observe a lot of loving relationships growing up.
Yeah.
You know, loving relationships between humans and people, but also loving relationships with the land and the waters and all of our more than human relatives. I didn't observe that. And so I think it has had a long-term, you know, an impact, you know, clearly in how I conceptualize love.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, you know, when that's what we're witness to. So both of my grandparents went to residential schools, and I know that, although I don't know of their experience what exactly happened, I know that this influenced the way that, you know, all my aunties and uncles and my mom were raised, and you know, this lack of saying I love you and maybe even showing I love you or demonstrating what it means to be loving you know, that does pass sort of intergenerationally. But also, I think that's so important for when thinking about from an Anishinaabeg worldview or an Indigenous worldview, how mainstream or white-streamed mental health practices can't really equate, like they're incommensurate with our healing or the way that we should be healed, even though the I'm not sure what the book is called, but the mental health, they have their little Bible, right, for what is considered, you know, a mental health diagnosis, how to treat them, and so on. I think that those are incommensurate with us because of things like our connection to the land as this relationship towards healing, right? The ways that we experience land and honor the land. I think a lot of Melissa K. Nelson's work with eco-erotics and thinking about the ways that if we're willing to be vulnerable and intimate with the land or other than human relations that we have, then we can rebuild those cognitive pathways that you're talking about in terms of the way that our body, the vulnerability, the seeping in of that intimacies of our environments will help us to reconnect or reconfigure those cognitive pathways that have been imperialized. Is that a word? I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Sure, let's make it a word.
It's definitely a word. I get it. I'm remembering these stories that I was reading from Chamawa Indian Boarding School here in, it was sort of at the Oregon-Washington border here, and where many of my relatives were taken to boarding school, and the stories of how when the children got there, they had to take everything off and scrub down and like the bathing of the children because they were dirty. And then making them scrub their knees until they were no longer brown. Of course, we all know that our knees are darker than the rest of our legs. And so they would scrub and scrub and scrub until they bled. And there's these pictures of all of these children, these young, beautiful babies from around here with bloody knees. Feeling brown, and especially in white spaces when I was younger, you know, like my ideas of beauty when I was younger was all related to whiteness and having blonde hair and being thin. And that I just am, I'm thinking of myself as like a teenager and the way that I imagined what I needed to be, to be considered desirable and to be considered beautiful. And I wanted to kind of just acknowledge that I've struggled with that in my own self, you know.
And the self-love.
Ugh. Yeah.
I remember growing up too, and my mom, I mean, props to my mom. She sat my sister and I down. We were teenagers. And she said, I want you guys to just know something. You will never look like these little white girls. You will never have their bodies. You will never fit their clothes. You will never be able to be in those bodies like they are. And you shouldn't want to be, because you're strong Cheyenne women. You have strong, you know, arms, strong backs, you're broad, you have shoulders, you know, you have legs that are strong, that have carried generations and that will continue to carry generations. And like, you know, I remember sitting there thinking, you know, I was an athlete, so to me it wasn't a huge kind of shock, but I know for my sister it really had an impact on her to think that, you know, she was never going to be a size 2, right? No matter how hard she tried. And so I just think as Indigenous women, the self-love that we have to reclaim and really restore, it's so hard.
Early on, you know, and even about shame, for instance, you know, my mom and aunties and grandmas would walk around naked. Like this was just kind of a normal thing in our family. I don't know if it's the same for others, but yeah. It was no kind of big deal just to see breasts and to see, you know, various parts of our, particularly our mothers and aunties' bodies or grandmas, you know, walking around in bra and those big underwears and whatever, right? Like, and so I'd become accustomed to this. I hadn't gone to school really yet. And then when I went to school, all of a sudden, you know, I was being indoctrinated into what it means to perform your body in certain ways, what's appropriate, what's not. And again, this is in a time that ideas of consent and sexual safety and making safer spaces wasn't a part of the educational curriculum. It was straight on puritanical, like policing bodies into how they should interact with one another, particularly in the home. And I remember going home and saying, "Mom, I think, you know, you're supposed to cover up your breasts." And then she just like looks at me. She's like, "Come on, baby girl. That's the white man teaching you that."
That's awesome.
And there, like, you know, I might have been 5 or 6, something like that, where I just started school. And it really sent me on this, that stuck with me for a long time, to think about the ways that in a home, in our private spaces, those bodies were viewed as non-shameful, that, you know, the breasts can be sexual, they can be also sacred, right? So we know that we're feeding children oftentimes, maybe we're not. They are a part of sex, if this is important for people, they may not be. So I think, you know, understanding that the ways that white society, patriarchal, cis, heteronormative society teaches us to view those bodies, to view another person's body, but also how to perform our own body, is something that Indigenous people have to contend with on a daily basis, right? And then what happens is this spills over into being policed by our own peers, right? Our own other Indigenous people. So those are like constantly grappling with the ways that loving our bodies, loving other people's bodies in ways that are consensual, that are ethically responsible, that care for the way that that body is going to perceive that behavior, but also carry that behavior, right? Because every action we have towards anybody's body is going to be taken up by that flesh and taken up through that musculature and carried forward with them. So I think if we're cognizant of how we treat bodies, refer to bodies, talk about bodies, touch bodies, is the most gentle and caring enactment of love that we could do for our kin. And I see this happening a lot. So we know what we've lost. We've lost language that discusses bodies in ways that that we can't formulate in the English language. You know, maybe the English language is constructed to carry on that shame or carry on the ideas of productivity, right? Being able to find terminology in English that Indigenous people have always had to describe our kin who are variously gendered or non-gendered or various ways that they practice sexualities and love. So we've lost that language. We've lost that connection to the land. Like I've, you know, in our own stories, in our own Anishinaabeg oral narratives, there's stories of Nibinabek, which are the mermaids. So mermaid, and in these stories, the mermaids come to shore. They take someone with them to go live in their metropolis, really. But they always bring them back so they could go visit their own families on shore. Then they meet again and they come back out into the lakescape. And I've been reflecting a lot on this, is that that's a transhuman relationship. Like for me, the mermaid can represent this transness in between a human and a fish coming together and becoming this sacred being. So there's so there's that idea of the physical, this corporeal transness. But then there's also that transness of relationships that I think is super, super beautiful and magical, that we have these stories, right? And we've always had these stories. So where did it kind of go into, well, we know where it went into these Christian ideas of a man and a man, you know, or a man and a man. No, they're totally against that. A man and a woman reproducing for, you know, whatever the, this, as Dr. Tallbear referred to in the earlier episode of yours, the, you know, the compulsory monogamy, which is so detrimental, right? So in thinking about that connection to the land, how we lost that loving connection, being displaced from the land, but also being cut off from our languages that describe the land in relational, loving ways. Like, we don't just name our land Duke of Edinburgh, or I don't know what people name, white people name their land, their lands they take, right? Like, it's always after someone. But us, as I understand in Anishinaabeg language and place naming, it's always named after the characteristic of the land. So people will go and view it, they'll spend time with it, they'll come to understand the spirit of that land, and then that's how they refer to it. So it's the land telling you how to refer to them, right? Instead of staking claim to it and mapping it in, making the land itself like a cognitively imperialist function. Mm-hmm. Because every time you refer to that land, it's king whatever, or I'm not sure, I don't even really care like what they name their lands, right? Or not their lands, the lands they've taken. When we think about the ways that we've been severed from even referring to the land that surrounds us is so profound, because then now we're calling it St. John's, or, you know, as opposed to its original name, which would have been the way that the land characterizes itself. So that's so there's just all these like layers of ways that our ability to love, or understanding of what love means, how to show love, how to embody love, has been severed. However, I think that it's so profound what people are doing right now to push back against that. So the Ogima Mikana project in Toronto, renaming street names, right? Like going out and kind of taking back those place names, putting up signs of what that original place would have been called. These are these ways that settlers especially are forced to confront, you know, what those lands mean. I think, you know, artistically, we have so many people that are just so profound. Like, I always cry, like, whenever Joshua Whitehead or Billy Belcourt wins some other, another thing. Like, I'm just like, holy nephews, you guys are just deadly, man. Like, this is just, like, it. Just thinking about them, you know, Ariel Twist, Jay Simpson, like trans people, trans kin. I don't want to say our, because we don't have a possessive over them, but trans Indigenous people, all these youths, you know, all of these people that are taking up what was lost, but in these really powerful and profound ways. Chief Lady Bird painting these images where you might look at it and, you know, our old colonial self would be shocked and shamed and disgusted, but really making this accessible to say, this image of this woman with big doo-doos and flat arse. Well, she emphasizes the arse a little bit. Maybe she's she might be willing something. She does. But having them be fat, having them be tattooed, having them have always sort of connected to some sort of ceremony or traditions in some way, I think this is really the vanguard. These are the people that are gonna start to change these perceptions and reintroduce that way that we have always understood love.
Beautiful. I love that. Everything you just said. I love having this conversation. I want to switch gears a little bit and thinking through this article, The Myths That Made America, Pocahontas and the Myth of Transatlantic Love. You know, the Pocahontas story is really the first story of love in the Americas, right? And it's this, you know, we know that it's a myth, right? Because what it does, you know, like the whole sacrificing her life to rescue her white lover from her barbarian tribe, but it excludes the narrative of rape and cultural destruction and genocide, and reinforces this sort of like white savior complex, or maybe was the beginning of it, you know, and how that narrative has deeply impacted every other narrative afterwards, kind of like set the precedence, so to speak. This idea that Indian women's bodies are for the taking, and our bodies should also be used to save white men. And what's interesting about this is that most of our women are marrying white men. And so how then is this narrative playing itself out in our lives right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. Thanks for asking that. So this immediately makes me think of Raina Green's writing on the Pocahontas Perplex, which describes this, and perhaps it's a foundational piece for this article. I haven't read it myself, but now I'm going to. But in here, you know, in Raina Green's writings, she's referring to the Pocahontas Perplex as being on one side, right, this veneration of the Indian princess, someone that is formulated through that aristocratic line, but who also, much like aristocracies and the way that England figures its land stuff and is patriarchal and what have you, is not able to actually have any ownership or control over that land, right? Mm-hmm. And through this, as you mentioned, through this upholding or taking the side of her white husband, who was actually her captor and rapist, because of course that's not really what happened in Disney's book, in the real story, she comes to represent Indigenous women who predominantly in many tribes would have been the caretakers of land, right? So like in matrilineal or matriarchal, clan mothers often would be the ones to decide, okay, who's going to sit in what land or those types of things, right? Negotiating land transfers and passage and whatnot. So in this narrative, she's unable to be that holder of the land. So she needs to like acquiesce that ownership to this white man, who comes to represent her, putting that moral and, I guess, ethical settler superiority, like she's transferring that onto him, that him and his people will be better caretakers of this land, that they know how to manage land because this is something that, you know, they've done whatever, right? There's all of these, so there's that sort of meaning that comes from that she comes to represent Indigenous people, putting that trust into a white man to take care of that land and to manage that land. So there's that. So we start, so this is Disney, 5-year-olds are watching this, right? And people don't realize the impact of discursive sort of colonialism too, or imperialism. But on the other hand, Raina Green talks about this Pocahontas perplexed being, that when Pocahontas represents that Indian princess, she's loved and celebrated because she is that passage into frontierism and settlement and what have you. So in that sense, she's revered. But on the other part of the perplex is that she's also reviled as the exotic S word, right? Like that when she comes to represent anything other than a vehicle to secure land, when she comes to represent anything exotic, anything romantic, anything about love, it's totally separate and she's the S word. So yes, so then she's reviled. So she has this double sort of jeopardy, but it's nothing that actually comes from herself. These are the ways that her body has been whitewashed and read and negotiated, but at the end of the day, it's all just to prop up the immediacy and the need for settler colonial control of those lands. You know, you mentioned earlier, Matika, that this story represents, yeah, absolutely, that these bodies are for the taking, right? That they're only a symbol, that they're only symbolic for how white men or whiteness or settler colonialism can continue to take over those lands and settle on those lands and keep those lands. And then on the same side, you know, Sarah Hunt would say there's a lot of violence in that first, but there's also a lot of violence in that her body can only symbolize something very specific, something to do with imperial order. But when her body represents something else, she's killable or she's rapable. The violence is to be inflicted on that body that doesn't uphold the sanctity of the ongoing settler colonial project. So Sarah Hunt would even say that it's so egregious that Indigenous women's bodies, when they're being violated against, it's not even considered rape, right? If you think about, you know, of course, what's happening with our sisters and our aunties and our grandmothers and our daughters and trans folks and two-spirit folks, you know, that through the legal system and the institution of the settler colonial judicial system, that the perpetrator of those are often not held to account, right? So what does that story tell you? That story tells you that even when those violences are made public through these events, that it's actually not even considered rape. You know, it's, she had issues with alcoholism. She was, you know, there's all these sort of, like, narratives and scenarios that prop up exactly what you're saying, that's been a narrative, a settler colonial, like, nostalgia for that Indian woman's body from Pocahontas. This was said to happen in the 1600s, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know what? That's the power of narrative. And it really makes me think of Thomas King and how Thomas King writes about the truth about stories and how the first story that we're told becomes the story that sticks with us and replays itself over and over and over again. You know, and so Thomas King in the book does a really great job of talking about the Anishinaabe creation story and the story of Sky Woman, and how in the story of Sky Woman, you know, God is a woman. It makes sense and gives birth to the world on this turtle's back. And I'm not going to tell your creation story. You could tell it better, but but you know, when you contrast that to the Christian creation story, which is made by a man with original sin, and woman comes from the rib bone of a man, and she's the original like temptress. And then, you know, how that story plays out in our society and how women are still disregarded. We're still fighting for, you know, our rightful place in society, so to speak. Anyways, I just think this original narrative about love in the Americas is replaying itself. Just hearing you say that and thinking of how, you know, they don't even want to call it rape.
Mm.
We're still having a very difficult time convicting predators in our communities. And our Native women's bodies are still undervalued. You know, we should do 100 episodes around this movement, you know, 1,000 episodes until our women are safe, you know, because they're not. And so it's sad, though, to me that when we want to talk about love, that we have to talk about love and its proximity to whiteness, love and its relationship with violence, you know, that we can't just talk about love in this new way. And that's kind of what I hope that we're working towards with the next generations, is that will we ever get to this place where we can talk about love without violence? Disruption doesn't mean absence, right? It doesn't mean that we're broken indefinitely. It doesn't mean that we don't know love. I've certainly have known enough love for a lifetime.
Matika's known all the love.
All the great big love. You know, I just want to, before I forget, remember what Tommy Porter told me when I asked him, you know, like, how do we heal from all this trauma? And he said, oh, it's the Gawanda Gwahwa. It's the great big love. You know that love that you feel when you see a brand new baby? And even if it's not your baby, and even if you're like I was before I had babies, where you're like, I'm not really into kids. I don't really care about them being around me in public places. But when you see a brand new baby, you can't help but be like, oh, you know, it brings a smile to your face. That feeling, he said to me, that's the feeling of the great big love. It's the love for creation. And that's the love that heals us, that puts us back together again.
Mm. When you said that, I started to get emotional, because that feeling to me is the feeling that I get when I'm surrounded by Native peoples, whether it be at a powwow, at a ceremony, you know, and it just, you kind of get overwhelmed. It's like this, we're still here. We're still singing. We're still dancing. We're still doing these things despite every effort, right, to ensure otherwise. And it makes me cry. And so I think that's that big love too, right? That kind of overwhelming emotion of we are still here. Mm-hmm. We are still loving. Mm-hmm. We are. And we're not broken. And so I have to ask, you know, this question. do we need to give ourselves permission to love? Or do we have to give ourselves permission to love ourselves, to love others, to love our lands, our waters, and our more than human relatives? What is it that stops us from loving or from receiving love?
What may be stopping us, you know, from all of this love that we're trying to get at is this reality that we experience real trauma, historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, ongoing trauma. And, you know, especially when we think about our last episode, unfortunately, when we talk about love, we're also talking about healing from abusive love. And I really can't answer how we heal from trauma. So I want to introduce a very knowledgeable expert and relative who has been working on intergenerational healing in Indian country for decades.
My name is Jalene Joseph. My tribal name is Doone, which in my language means small woman. And I'm a member of the Aani, or White Clay People of Fort Belknap, Montana. And I'm the executive director of the Native Wellness Institute.
I asked Jalene to share with our listeners how we can heal from historical trauma so we can be good at love. Let's hear what Auntie Jalene has to say.
Our work is based in the notion that our communities are impacted by historical and intergenerational trauma. And then we know that where there has been trauma, healing is the answer. Healing ourselves physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. The work that we do then helps people, one, have awareness of like some of the lasting behaviors based on trauma. And then more importantly, like what are the tools and solutions to help that person to heal and to move forward? You know, a lot of people hear those words, historical trauma or intergenerational trauma. And then a lot of our people respond by saying, oh, you're still talking about that? Geez, just get over it already. You know, it happened so long ago. And I agree that we do need to get over it, but we have to figure out what is the it that we need to get over. Just get over it. So the it is the lasting behavior. There's actually been research done that shows people that experience trauma display 21 behavioral characteristics. And some of those behavioral characteristics include things like being a chaos junkie, you know, enjoying that chaos, enjoying that drama. And most people that do, they don't have that awareness, but yet like drama and chaos is everywhere in their life, right? And so part of that is because we're bringing it to us. And part of it, when we grow up in trauma, when we grow up in chaos and that becomes our norm, we operate very well in chaos. And so when we don't have chaos, then we create it so we can feel comfortable. Or another lasting impact of trauma is that chronic negativity. We see that play out everywhere, right? In our communities, chronic negativity, the need to be in control, or the need to be right, or frequent periods of depression. So those are just a few examples of the way that trauma continues to play out, right? And some of these reasons are exactly why we developed the curriculums to help our people find the solutions to help people move forward. So the first step really is about awareness. We can't change or try to bring healing to ourselves until we have awareness. When we look back into our cultures, especially pre-colonization, we can look at the proof, and the proof is in like our languages, in our songs, in our dances, in our ceremonies, that really shows that our people were positive thinkers, and positive thinkers are positive doers. So for example, when we translate, you know, even when we say things like, you know, hello, or hey, how's it going, or see you later, or, you know, like common things like that, when we translate them, it's much more meaningful and much more deeper meanings in our languages, right? Or we didn't have derogatory words to, you know, that we said to each other. That's part of our healing that we have to switch. And, you know, we talk about the epidemics in Indian country. I say there's an epidemic of chronic negativity. Our mental health is also connected to our spiritual health and our emotional health and our physical health. So it's really that holistic view that we have to take a look at it. When we look at healing, then it's about letting go of some of the things that we hold on to that don't serve us in a good way, letting go of the things that hold us back or keep us down, letting go of the things that may keep us paralyzed in that fear. And so we can let go of things in a variety of ways. For example, we'll do this letting go ceremony sometimes, and we might take people outside and ask them to pick up a rock, and they're gonna stand or sit with that rock for a little bit and just kind of almost like have a conversation with the rock and give the rock whatever it is that they're ready to let go of on that day. So maybe it might be anger or rage or some shame or guilt or resentment or, you know, whatever. Something that they're ready to let go of in that moment on that day, and then to give it to that rock. And then we ask them to throw that rock. But before we ask them to throw that rock, because the natural law teaches us there's always an opposite to everything. So we ask them to thank that anger or to thank that resentment or to thank whatever it is that they're ready to let go of, because it served some purpose for them. That's why they held on to it. So you thank it, and then you symbolically throw that rock as a way to let go of whatever it is that you're ready to let go of. So usually what happens, because we're only human, is that maybe a second later or a minute later, we pick it right back up. And we do that with our minds by thinking about it. So then we have to let it go again. And then sometimes we have to let it go again and again and again and again, until we really let it go. Just like when we want to get better at basketball or writing or dancing or weaving or singing, like we have to practice, right? So we can practice letting go so we can be good at letting go. Once we let go, we have to fill that back up with something good, with something positive. So our people need to understand what it feels like to feel good, you know, and when we think about when we go to the canoe journey, or we go to another kind of tribal gathering or tribal celebration, and it's the vibration of the drums, it's people's energy that they're feeling good on. They feel that love, they feel that compassion. And so when we let go of things, then we need to fill that back up. So an example of how we fill that back up, we might do an affirmation exercise. So we might sit in a circle, and everybody turns to their, at one at a time, turns to their person to their left, and they give them a positive affirmation. They tell them something good about themselves. And then they turn to the next person, and then they tell that person something nice. And you go all the way around the circle like that. And most often, there's tears during that exercise, because we don't tell people nice things often, right? So for people to like genuinely hear and feel these good words that somebody are saying about them, like fills up something. You know, we all heal in different ways. So different genders are going to heal in different ways. Different age groups are going to heal in different ways. Different people based on your geographic location are going to heal in different ways. We have traditional ways of healing that are still there, right? Whether it's running, whether it's fasting, whether it's feasting, whether it's, you know, going into, you know, some kind of sweat lodge or other, you know, ceremony. So we have lots and lots of traditional ways of healing. And then we also have lots and lots of contemporary ways of healing. And then we have lots of ways of integrating those two to find ways. But regardless of what you do, there's no right or wrong way, because your healing is just that. It's yours. I always say there's kind of like three steps. The first step is like we have to want healing. And that might seem like, well, who doesn't want healing? But when you really think about that, everyone doesn't want healing. We might be benefiting from, still in our minds, we might be benefiting from the stuff that we're holding on to. And then the second thing to think about is that we have to feel worthy of healing. We have to feel worthy of healing because of trauma, right? Because of their life experiences. So we have to take a look at that, people feeling worthy. And then the last part is we have to believe. We have to believe that we can feel better. We have to believe that we can be healed. Taking action to do something differently than what you're currently doing. We can ask for help. And what we do and what healers do is they help people believe that they can heal themselves. We're not healing anyone. We're providing the tools and the opportunities, but it's the person that's doing their own healing. We're not healing them. And then just being aware that once we get the healing tools, it's going to help us our lifetime, because trauma continues to happen. Losing a friendship to whatever is trauma. Losing a pet is trauma, you know, changing a job. Like there's all kinds of examples of trauma that continues to happen. So these tools then can really last us a lifetime.
I think that this idea of chronic positivity is something to aspire to. You know, I can see the need for daily ritual. I can see the need for like recommitting and rededicating myself to a set of spiritual values and the need to do that on a regular basis. And I think chronic positivity is one of those values I can aim to aspire to. You know, I always think that for me, what has been most healing in my life is ceremony and connecting with elders. And certainly my relationship with the Coast Salish Sea has, I think, taken grief from me in ways that only the ocean could. You know, like going and doing a spirit bath and praying with my family has always been the best way for me to find healing. But I think that there's also like this process of needing to like ready myself for love. Like I can't transmit something I don't have type of idea, you know? And so in order to be able to transmit love, I have to be able to love myself, and I have to be whole and healthy. And that has been a process that I've been on, you know, like this my own healing journey. And so I love how Jalene talks about getting into this wellness journey, and that we're all in different places in that journey, but that, you know, my work is to be conscious of my own healing and to do that work.
Yeah. I mean, I thank you. I think we are all on our own healing journeys, and some of us don't even know that yet. Right? Or for some of us, we're in the midst of this healing journey, and it's really painful. And I want to acknowledge that, you know, that healing isn't always nice. It doesn't always feel good, right? There's a lot of hurt and pain that sometimes needs to move through our bodies, and we have to feel it. This kind of reminds me of recently, I was reading about a discussion where somebody was talking about, well, I made X, Y, and Z choices, and because I made these choices, this is the outcome. I was able to achieve this, or I was able to make this kind of money or get this kind of job. And then somebody responded in that discussion and was like, actually, no, you didn't make those choices. You had these choices available to you. Not everybody has these choices available to them based on their race, based on where they're raised, based on who they are, who their family is. And so this was in response to, or in the context of kind of economic or social kind of mobility. But I think about this in response to love and in response to relationships, like romantic love, platonic love, healthy love, passionate love, transformative love, healing love. Those choices aren't available to all of us. You know, there are obstacles in the way. There are sometimes obstacles in the way that go generations back. Mm-hmm. And so how do we create opportunities for all these different kinds of love and connection to be available to us, mm-hmm. to be available to future generations?
Mm-hmm. For me, getting sober was like a huge part of being able to give and receive love. That I found when I was drinking, when I was smoking a lot of weed and doing the other things, that my spirit was crossing over. You know, like that's how the elders talk about it. In my community, they say when you are frequently ingesting these substances that have had their spirit changed, it also changes your spirit. When I was doing that and I wasn't conscious on a regular basis and like consuming these mind and mood altering substances, I like was literally incapable of making loving choices. And when I wasn't making loving choices, it was leading me down a destructive path where I was not in a place that I could actually be loving, you know, to myself and certainly not to others. So for me, like to be able to give and receive love, it started first with getting sober. And I mean, I don't ever talk about this publicly, you know, but I've been sober now since I was 17 years old for, you know, like nearly 20 years, for a really long time.
Yeah.
You know, this like learning to love, give and receive love has been a process for me, you know, and I'm certainly a product of Res Life. You know, I didn't escape that. And so I had to find ways to heal from my own trauma. And that was always rooted in ceremony for me. And it has been. And connection to people. And also, you know, like being a photographer and a journalist has also brought me incredible amounts of love and connection. You know, because having a camera has granted me access into a lot of spaces that I don't know how else I would grant access. And so I've been able to travel, which has been like my greatest love of my 20s and most of my 30s, you know, like traveling all around the world to meet and encounter incredible people. And, you know, like I always think to myself, like, man, I've been on like every continent. I've lived, set up residency and had great relationships, you know, and like the love of my life, you know, in on several continents. And so
you can have many loves.
Really? You know, I do believe that.
You can have many loves in this lifetime and all those to come. I firmly believe that.
I do too. You know, and so but for me, you know, like this great big love that I've been like opening myself to has been a process, you know, because I think when I experienced trauma, parts of me like physically started to close down as I experienced trauma. Like my heart started to close, my mind started to close, my eyes started to close, and everything inside of me started to close down from the world around me. And there's this ceremony, a condolence ceremony that's done out in Haudenosaunee country. And the idea is like, I clean your eyes so you can see clearly again. I smudge your ears. I clean your ears so you can hear clearly again. I wipe your heart so you can feel the love around you again, so you can see the love all over again. Because when we become traumatized, it becomes very difficult to see the love around us, you know? And so I think like, it was the great big love that allowed me, you know, like to open. And it took a really long time to be open enough and vulnerable enough to give love and receive love, you know. And so I think lately what I've been thinking about is like, you know, since having a baby, like I didn't know there was more love in the world. You know, I didn't know I could love like this. I just didn't. I think women told me like, oh, when you have kids, everything's going to change. And, you know, like your life won't be about yourself anymore. Your life will be about your baby. And they told me things like that. And I was like, shit, you know,
like, but really,
come on, you know. And then I had Alma B and everything changed. And I suddenly knew this love that I had just never encountered. Like, I just don't think I've ever loved anything so much in my entire life. And and what a great blessing it's been to know this kind of love. I feel really fortunate and lucky, you know, and hopefully, and this is the part that I've been terrified about, is like, hopefully I can create an environment for her, a home environment where she knows and feels love on a regular basis. I consciously try to tell her I love her every day. And it sounds silly, but it doesn't feel natural to me. You know, it just feels like, it feels silly, but to say that, you know, but it's something I try to do. And I try really hard to do that because of all the stories that I've heard from grandmas who told me that, you know, they never heard that from their mom. Yeah. And so
that's deep.
That's where I'm at with it right now. I'm certainly not an expert on the topic, though. You know, these are just my thoughts. What do I know? I know nothing. So how about you, Desi?
I want to talk a little bit, I guess, about this ceremonial way. Like when I think about opening myself up to love and being ready for love and welcoming that, I think about the ceremony that we have as Cheyenne people where we call our spirits back. And so we have a ceremony that we do where we literally call our spirits back to us, back into our bodies, so that we can be made whole again. And it's not an elaborate ceremony. It's not something that we do that's like super complicated, or it doesn't require a lot. Some of our ceremonies are very complicated and require a lot, and we have to plan and prepare and save for a very long time. But this ceremony is super basic. And I think because it's so basic and it's so accessible, it makes me think that it's because we need it so often. It's something, you know, like I've had my spirit called back lots of different times because I know when it's gone, or others know when it's gone. You know, it's like, it's these moments when we're disconnected. It's these moments when the trauma takes over. It's these moments when our brains take over and we're no longer feeling. It happened to me when I was at Stanford and in a really intense academic environment. It happened when I was traveling all over the world and having a lot of fun, but probably not making the best choices. It happened when I was in an abusive relationship and I was getting hit and beaten. Mm. It happened when I gave birth in a very traumatic way. You know, I think to me, when I think about love, especially self-love, I think about my spirit. Mm-hmm. And I think about how the spirit name that we have, at least for Cheyennes, are the name that the ancestors and the spirits know us by, are the Cheyenne names that we are given. And so that's why these names are so important. And so for me, my spirit goes by the Cheyenne name Mukshihut. And so when I was growing up, my mom and my grandma, my aunties, you know, they'd always tell me, you can call your spirit back anytime by just asking her to come back. Mm. Just talk to her, tell her to come back. And so when I think about love, I think about before I can truly love anybody else or anything else, for me, Mukshihut has to be with me. And sometimes, you know, it takes longer for her to come back. And I know that it's because there's so much trauma, or there's so much distance, or there are so many obstacles that she has to overcome to come back. But when I had my son, it's very similar to you, Matika. I never thought of myself as a mom. I was born to be an auntie. Aunties run the world. Auntie life is the best life. Mom life is hard. It's so hard. It's beautiful, but it's hard. But when I had my son, and he's probably the only child I'll ever have, and I'm okay with that. I've come to peace with that. But when I had my son, it was the same way, Matika. Like, there was a completely different love that I became privileged to access. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful, and it makes me so strong. You know, I now know why mothers are so, so strong, and why our grandmothers are even stronger. Mm. But it also made me kind of sad, because I remember young girls, you know, 14 and 15 year old girls in my community who got pregnant, you know, and I knew that they were going to face a hard life. Because, you know, they were just starting out and they were single moms with these new babies. And they told me, you know, I had a baby because I wanted to know love. Mm. And it just makes me so sad to think that, you know, we can be so traumatized by life that we don't know love. Mm. And so we have to call it into this world, right? Mm-hmm. So that we can feel it and experience it. And that's, to me, like that ancestral love. Like, we can literally call love into this world for ourselves. And I believe it because our babies are that. And so that's where I'm at with love right now. You know, and that I think we also should talk about how some loves aren't forever. And they don't have to be forever to have meaning and to be beautiful. And so, you know, like, I believe, like you, I believe in lots of different soulmates and lots of different loves of my life at different times of my life. And I've experienced beautiful, beautiful love and powerful love in many different places. So I think we also need to be very open to love coming and going at different times, different kinds of love. I always tell people that one of my deepest and dearest soulmates is a little gay Navajo man who I met when I was very young. Shout out to Mar, who is, you know, probably the longest love I've ever had and probably the longest love I will ever have. And it's platonic and spiritual and beautiful. And so we can have all different kinds of love that fulfill us in all different kinds of ways.
Yeah, I can't help but think of Auntie Kim, who says, you know, like, I'm never alone. I'm never alone. You know, I'm always in relationship. And this idea that I'm a single or coupled is a Western paradigm. That's like some Western white people. Stop saying that. That's what she said. Stop saying that.
Because you're never single as a Native person. And if you are, wow, what a sadness, you know, to not be in relation with anything. What a sadness.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, for those that are listening or for those that are feeling alone right now, I just want to take a moment to extend my love out to you, you know, and to remind you that you're not alone, you know, like that the earth is holding you. And I learned that, you know, when I was coming of age and doing my fasting, you know, and I went out and spent time with the land, and it was hard. You know, I think Desi, I don't know like your spirit, your prayer lives and your guys' ceremonial ways in Cheyenne country, but you know, when we go out to do this, that kind of spiritual work, like you were talking about, and it's some ceremonies are easy and some are really hard. and sometimes
you can do the same ceremony over again and it feel completely different.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Yeah, totally. And and just like that big lesson for me that I learned at that time, I'll never forget, you know, like I was feeling like really alone and scared and lonely. And I felt like in that moment, like the earth, like Pachamama like spoke to me and was like, I'm always holding you. I'm always cradling you. And I sort of like imagine like Mother Earth's like wrapping her arms around me. And like, and I looked around and I realized that, you know, like that there was this grass and the sky and there was some deer off in the distance. And there was like this little bee buzzing by me. And I was like, I'm not alone. I'm not alone. You know, like my ancestors are with me. And it certainly doesn't come easily. It never did for me. It's not like because I'm an Indian, I like woke up with relationship to cedar trees. You know, it was like it was nurtured and developed over a long period of time. and I certainly don't like go out to the woods and like I don't like hear the cedar trees talking to me. I know that the ancestors, like I know that they could. I know they could talk to the tree people. Like there used to be a time in our history when our people actually were in relationship with the tree people, and the tree people gave them very specific teachings and agreements were made. But I certainly haven't reached that spiritual plane yet, you know. So I don't want to like sound like I'm all like somehow
super,
you know,
sacred.
Super sacred or something. I'm not.
Well, I mean, I sure as hell aren't. Yeah, I'm not super sacred either. I'm not even kind of sacred. But but this makes me. This is why I also want folks to know that like, when we're talking about ceremony, we're talking about very specific ceremony, right? That is specific to our journeys and to our experiences. But everybody has ceremony in some way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe running is your ceremony, right? Maybe writing is your ceremony. Mm-hmm. Maybe cooking, maybe laughing. You know, we all have our different forms of ceremony. And so when I think about love, maybe that's what love is. Mm. Maybe love is ceremony. Did we always have love in our communities? I think so. I know so. I think ultimately we would not be here today if we did not have love in our communities for generations, mm-hmm. from the very beginning. From the very beginning, if we did not have love, we would not be here today. I do believe that. Maybe that's the biggest kind of unlearning that we have to do as Indigenous peoples, is that love is so much more than romantic love.
Mm.
And that there are so many different ways to love. Love for everything.
The great big love.
Yeah, it's that great big love. That's all we have for you today, folks. Thank you so much, relatives, for being on this journey with us. We love you. We appreciate you. And if nobody's told you today, you are so, so, so loved in that great big love kind of way. In that vein, please join us. Be a part of our community. Join the work that we're doing on Patreon. Find us on Instagram at AMR Podcast. Send us a voice memo on our website. Go to the contact page, scroll down, find the voice record, and send us some of your thoughts. We love to hear from you. Please like and subscribe wherever it is that you listen to this pod. It really helps us out. Thank you to the AMR team, all of you that put this work together. Thank you for making it happen. Thank you to Geraldine King, Auntie Henrietta Mann, Jalene Joseph, and Uncle Rob, also known as Robert Waldinger, the TED Talk guy.
All my relations.